nothing has changed to convince us that what will happen up in the headwaters of the river that we depend on is going to keep us safe.
Dillingham residents speak out against the Pebble Mine. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 27th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a tender grounded for 2 months near Bristol Bay will stay that way for now.
We don't really have at this time any kind of an estimation on when the salvage plan will be finalized.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Political, business, and tribal leaders from the Bristol Bay region welcomed the new EPA administrator to Dillingham today. They called on the EPA to step in and stop development of the proposed Pebble Mine. KDLG's Michael Mason has the story.
Last month, after a long and contentious confirmation process, Gina McCarthy became the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Shortly after taking over the EPA, McCarthy was asked to visit the Bristol Bay region to get some firsthand knowledge of the proposed Pebble Mine. McCarthy's visit happened Tuesday. She started the day with meetings with tribal leaders from across the region and then made her way to the Dillingham Middle School gym for a public meeting that the EPA labeled as an open house. Nearly 250 people turned out, and many of them were given a chance to speak. That's exactly what McCarthy said she was hoping for.
I am here not to talk to you, but to listen and to learn. EPA is all about making sound decisions, and the basis of our decisions is always an open public process where we listen to people's concerns and where we follow the science.
The EPA has become a player in the Pebble Mine controversy because of the draft Bristol Bay watershed assessment, which the agency hopes to have finalized later this year. McCarthy noted that the scientific assessment of the Nooshiegak and Quijack River watersheds is intended to inform the EPA's future decision-making about whether or not to impose restrictions on large-scale mining in the Bristol Bay region.
I know how important this issue is. I know, and I'm learning more and more about what it means for your culture, what it means for your communities, what you believe it means for future generations and your children and grandchildren. That's important for me to hear and to understand. So right now, I am going to shut up and listen.
Most of those who were given speaking time Tuesday morning were leaders in the region. Dillingham Mayor Alice Ruby reiterated the city's 2006 stance in opposition to development of the Pebble Mine.
Nothing has changed to convince us that what will happen up in the headwaters of the river that we depend on is going to keep us safe.
The proposed Pebble Mine and many of the other possible large mining developments would be located in the region just north of Lake Iliamna in what many believe are the headwaters of the Nooshiegak and Quijack Rivers, which are two of the most productive salmon rivers on Earth. Many of those given time Tuesday to speak to the EPA administrator were Alaskan Native leaders. Lukey Acklecock Sr. is the president of the Equawk Village Council. Equawk sits on the shores of the Nooshiegak River. Acklecock opposes development of the Pebble Mine and claims the exploration activities are impacting the natural environment near the proposed mine site.
I own a cabin on the Coctulee River that I take my grandchildren and to each year, and I've seen the change of salmon returning over the years since Pebble have increased their drilling during exploring. I have seen less and less salmon in the river over time.
One of the most vocal and well-known opponents of allowing large-scale mining in the Bristol Bay region is Robin Samuelson. He's a commercial fisherman and president of the board of directors of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, which is the local community development quota organization for the coastal areas of Bristol Bay. Samuelson is also a member of the Chogyang Tribal Council. Back in May of 2010, the Chogyang Tribal Council, along with several other tribal councils in the region, asked the EPA to use a power granted the agency in the Clean Water Act to stop development of the proposed Pebble Mine. That request resulted in the EPA deciding to conduct the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. Samuelson thanked the EPA for stepping into the pebble mine issue and then took issue with how the state government has handled the matter.
We've had three governors that doesn't support us. Most of the Republican legislature does not support us, both in the House and the Senate. They don't even come out here and have hearings with us. They don't even recognize our subsistence needs, or let alone our tribal status out here. The state is on a whole different mission, and I find it really ironic that your agency, all the way from Washington, D.C., has the interest to come up and listen to us when our own state has turned their back on us.
The proposed pebble mine would sit on state-owned land, and the position of the Parnell administration and many state lawmakers is that it would be inappropriate for the EPA to circumvent the existing regulatory framework by stopping development before the Pebble Limited Partnership applies for permits that would start the NEPA permitting process. During her closing comments at Tuesday's meeting in Dillingham, McCarthy didn't shed any light on whether or not the EPA would use its 404C authority to stop large-scale mining in the region. However, she did label Bristol Bay as very important.
It's our responsibility to make sure that we understand the issues underlying those decisions, what the science tells us, and what it means for the people that the Environmental Protection Agency serves. And that is you.
With that, McCarthy and her entourage headed out the door for a planned trip to Illiamna. Her trip was scheduled to include a visit to the proposed Pebble Mine site, facilitated by the Pebble Limited Partnership. The partnership still plans to release the mine plan sometime later this year, with a goal of entering into the NEPA permitting process late this year or in early 2014. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The 78-foot sunken fishing tender Lone Star is still stuck in the mud in the Ogeechic River as responders try to figure out a new way to recover the vessel. The vessel grounded on June 30th while taking fish from the local fishermen for processing by Trident Seafoods. It began taking on water and eventually capsized in about 18 feet of water. It's been sitting on the bottom of the Ogeechic River since that time, and it looks like it will stay there for a little while longer as responders try to figure out a way to get the vessel unstuck from the mud. Petty Officer Sean Eggert is a spokesman for Coast Guard Sector Anchorage, which is monitoring the recovery effort.
The crews out at the site are still working on a new salvage plan after their last attempt to bring the vessel up out of the river failed.
The salvage company Magone Marine Services was hired to lighter the fuel off the Lone Star and to salvage the vessel. It took over a month, but the fuel tanks were eventually emptied. But efforts to refloat the Lone Star have so far been unsuccessful. Petty Officer Eggert says it's unknown when a new approach will be tried.
We don't really have at this time any kind of an estimation on when the salvage plan will be finalized, or even when they'll or how long the completion of this work will take. The last plan that had been, or the last thing that had been talked about as far as a potential plan was to bring in a larger crane that would have more strength, a larger capacity to try and tug the boat up off the riverbed.
The Lone Star is currently sitting on the bottom of the river near the river's mouth. Eggert says removing the vessel from its current location is a priority.
I can say that the vessel where it is a hazard to navigation, so leaving it in the river could cause some problems with vessels that want to transit through that area.
At the time of the sinking, the Lone Star was carrying over 13,000 gallons of diesel fuel and about 300 gallons of other petroleum products. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation reports that all of the fuel has been removed from the vessel. Petty Officer Eggert says the responders are still trying to figure out how much diesel and other petroleum products leaked into the Ogeechic River. Sheening was seen from the time the vessel went down until August 9th, when the lightering efforts were complete. Eggert says responders are working on a new salvage plan, which must be approved by the Coast Guard before it can be implemented. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a raising ceremony for 5 totem poles in Southeast.
It's also lifting up our spirit as Native people, and I think it's good and healing for us to be able to do something like this for Tlingit people all across Southeast.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
The Salmon Project in Alaska. Salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The Nature Conservancy is becoming more involved in the Susitna-Wautana Hydroelectric Project. This summer, contractors working under the Alaska Energy Authority have been conducting 58 studies to assess the environmental impact of the hydroelectric project. The Nature Conservancy, which operates in 35 countries and the United States, has hired a consultant to review the data that the studies produce and generate an independent assessment of some of the environmental risks. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
AEA says that the proposed dam would generate enough power to fill the needs of half of the Rail Belt's current consumers at a cost of $5.19 billion. Some opponents of the dam claim that environmental impacts would outweigh the benefit of what would be one of the tallest dams in America. The Nature Conservancy plans to conduct an independent evaluation of the study data to see how significant the environmental impacts will be on one of South Central Alaska's key industries.
For the Susitna-Wautana Hydro Project, we want to use that framework to look at what are the risks to salmon in particular, salmon habitat, from that project if it were to be built.
That's Corrine Smith. She oversees the Nature Conservancy's efforts in the Mat-Su Basin. To sift through the large amount of fishery data, the Conservancy has brought in Anchor QEA, a nationwide engineering and environmental consulting firm with offices in Anchorage. Smith says that the data currently being gathered could prove useful in determining the potential impact of the Susitna-Wautana Dam as well as future hydroelectric projects.
If we were to build a big dam on any large river like the Susitna in the state, we'll use the Susitna as a case study because there's so much information about that particular river, and there will be in the next year and two years after AEA studies.
That wealth of data will include information on the spawning areas and run strength of various salmon, as well as potential impacts on salmon habitat, such as water flow rate, silt accumulation, vegetation, and changes in how the river freezes. The determinations that the Nature Conservancy and Anchor QEA reached are not purely for their own use, however, and Smith hopes that others will find the data helpful.
Our goal is also to provide information for other stakeholders in the process to be able to have a clear framework for how to assess the impacts from the study. That's something that is a lot of information, and it's a little unclear yet how it all flows together. And so we're taking just one piece of it, and that's salmon. Obviously, there's a lot of other impacts from the dam or potential impacts, and we're just looking at the salmon piece of it.
Smith says that the Nature Conservancy plans to keep in line with AEA's study timeframe and expects to reach some conclusions by the end of 2014. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium plans to close Front Street Clinic on October 1st, according to the consortium COO Dan Neumeister. The decision by the board of directors comes after 2 days of meetings last week. KTOO's Lisa Fu has this report.
Search COO Dan Neumeister says deciding to close the clinic geared for homeless and low-income patients was difficult. He cites budgetary constraints, including sequestration. Dan Austin with the Juneau Coalition on Housing and Homelessness says he's not surprised with Search's decision.
I think that we have reached a point where we need to make that transition. I believe that for 10 years, Search has done a wonderful service for the community, but we need to find an alternative.
According to Neumeister, Front Street Clinic costs about $600,000 a year to operate. $160,000 of that comes from a Health Resources and Services Administration grant. The remaining more than $400,000, he says, comes from Search. Neumeister says Search makes that money through billings at its facilities. The HRSA grant went into effect May 1st and is good for 1 year. Neumeister does not know how much, if any, of the $160,000 remains, but says he is working with the federal agency on how leftover funds can be redesignated. Neumeister plans to hold a meeting in Juneau today to facilitate discussions on how the clinic can stay open. Neumeister did not identify who would be at the meeting, but the City and Borough of Juneau and the Juneau Coalition on Housing and Homelessness confirmed they will have representatives present. Dan Austin with the Coalition is optimistic that the community will find a solution.
The big issue is going to be in the event that the HRSA grant cannot keep the doors open at Front Street Clinic, where can we go to find some additional resources? That's a big challenge in this time, but you know, this is a community that can step up to the plate and do that.
Neumeister says SEARCH remains committed to taking care of Alaska Native homeless. The responsibility of the general public, says Neumeister, needs to go back to the general public. He says Juneau has other organizations responsible for the homeless. Neumeister also plans on meeting with members of Front Street Clinic staff today. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
The board of directors for Buccaneer Energy has a new look again, just weeks after an attempt to overtake the board by two Singapore-based investment companies was only partially successful. KDLL's Shailen Cochran has more.
In a press release, the company announced that three of its six board members resigned effective August 14th. Nicholas Davies, Clinton Adams, and Sean Scott had only been on the board since July 2nd when they were nominated by Pacific Hill International and Harbor Sun Limited, both based in Singapore. Those two companies hold approximately 5.5% of Buccaneers' issued capital funds. The board split earlier this summer was about Buccaneers' future plans for the jack-up rig Endeavor. The Singapore faction felt the focus should narrow to onshore development of natural gas, while the rest of the board, which includes Buccaneer founder and CEO Curtis Burton and executive chairman Dean Galagos, supported using Endeavor in Cook Inlet. Now, Buccaneer will enlist the help of a search firm to find a new board member. It will also have to work out another board appointee with yet another investment firm. Meridian Capital, which has an almost 20% interest in Buccaneer, gets to appoint its own nominee as part of the deal it signed back in June. That Buccaneer's board is in a prolonged game of musical chairs should be of interest to Alaska taxpayers. They're one of the company's partners by way of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. ADA has invested more than $23 million into Kenai Offshore Ventures, which co-owns Endeavor with Buccaneer, and another investment company, Ezeon, which took a 50% interest in Kenai Offshore Ventures when it signed on in 2011. From Kenai, I'm Shailen Cochran.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskananookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The oldest Catholic church in Bethel was totaled by a fire early Sunday morning. The structure of the First Immaculate Conception Church still remains, but the inside is blackened. The fire department worked to put out the fire for about 3.5 hours. The old church was built in 1943 and was used for about 12 years until a new church was built. At that point, the old church became the parish hall. A few years ago, it became the rummage room, where the church would sell donated items for next to nothing. They plan to continue to hold rummage sales once they figure out a new location. Volunteers from Petersburg were not able to free a humpback whale tangled up in a gill net near Petersburg on Friday and Saturday. Members of Petersburg's whale entanglement team Friday morning responded to the call of a whale caught in a gill net in Frederick Sound. Petersburg Marine Mammal Center President Barry Bracken says he and other volunteers boated out to the tangled whale caught in gear still connected to the fishing boat around Friday morning.
We've worked with the whale attached to the boat for a couple of hours. We're not making much headway with it. The whale at one point had swept under the boat, and so we had the gill net gear wrapped around the prop and shaft, and so the boat was immobilized. And we decided at that point that it probably would be better to cut the whale free and try to work at it, on it as a free-swimming whale and allow the vessel with escort to return to Petersburg.
The entanglement team kept trying to cut the gear loose for several more hours on Friday, but were unable to free the animal. Instead, they attached a buoy and tracking device, allowing them to find the whale again Saturday morning. Bracken describes it as a large adult humpback with what looks like two wraps of lead line from the gillnet.
It looks like those go back underneath the pectoral fins to a large mass of gear below the fluke. Fluke is relatively clear. The blowhole itself is clear. There's not much net on the netting on the back of the animal, but it appears that there's a very large mass of combined cork line, lead line, and web that is just below the fluke, and so he can't even raise his tail up out of the water, and it really can't raise it close enough for us to get any kind of a purchase on that.
The North Pacific Large Whale Disentanglement Network, which includes the local team members, is tracking the whale. Local volunteers may try again to free the whale tomorrow if weather conditions are better and the animal has not traveled too far away from Petersburg. Five totem poles were raised on Prince of Wales Island during a three-day ceremony earlier this month. KRBD's Sean Carlson attended the events in Klawock and has this story.
This is the sound of dozens of feet shuffling in unison. The guy you hear on the megaphone, Nick Nickerson, leads the procession from the front in an orange construction vest. And as you will soon come to know, everything here is accompanied by music. The shuffling feet belong to a diverse assortment of men and boys. Native or non-native, young or old, short or tall, they all work together, carrying a massive piece of cedar wood on their shoulders. But this isn't just any group of men carrying a giant piece of wood. They are participating in a three-day clinket ceremony that will see five totem poles raised into position in Klawock on Prince of Wales Island. This particular totem is the mythological raven pole. It takes the group of men, followed by onlookers and a traditional Tlingit singing group, only a few minutes to carry the thousands-pound pole from the carving shed to Klawock's Totem Park. A large crowd has gathered in the park to watch the men hoist the pole onto a stand.
Give him a hand, ladies and gentlemen.
Thankfully today, the sun is out. The same could not be said for past years or even the final day of this ceremony, during which at least 100 people stood for hours in a drenching downpour. The weather today is welcome because the work isn't done after the men carry the pole to the location. They roll it over and tie ropes to the top, and it's then, when Nick Nickerson switches from the bullhorn to a microphone, that the real fun begins.
Okay, have your attention. This line right here is the power. This line right here is the power. That line down there, you guys are going to stabilize it. As it goes up and we say halt, then we'll just keep tension on all the ropes.
That banging noise you hear. Wait, we almost forgot. There's music for this, too. Anyway, that banging noise is a large piece of metal being hammered into the base of the totem. But what's going on around the pole is worth explaining. The long ropes tied around the top of the pole are stretched taut. On the other ends are groups of at least 20 people each. Under Nick's direction, they have hoisted the pole up, and until that nail is hammered in, they are the only thing keeping the massive totem from falling over. When the pole is finally bolted into place, the crowd cheers again, this time for themselves.
Give yourselves a hand. Nice job.
The carving of these poles, along with others in the totem park, was led by John Rowan, who has been working on totems since he was a child. He says, though, that he owes his knowledge and passion to other masters in the craft.
I learned at my father's knee, where I really got into it. It was when I went to high school, and Stan Marsden, who's a Simsiad master carver, was instructed in the school. And he's the guy that introduced me to, you know, like Nathan Jackson, who's just phenomenal, and where I'm at today is because of all of them.
The totems for this ceremony, along with others that have stood in Kluak since the 1990s, are known as mortuary poles commemorating the dead. They are reproductions of original carvings from Tuxacan, an ancestral winter village of the Tlingit people. The Great Depression-era Civilian Conservation Corps had recarved the ancient poles in the 1930s, much like many of the poles found in and around Ketchikan. But due to time and age, Rowan has been charged with reproducing them again. The carver didn't build all of these beautiful totems by himself. He was aided by a number of students of his from the Kluak school where he teaches carving. For the past 2 decades, Rowan has brought up students from early grade school until they are off to college, cultivating new carvers along the way. Around 8th grade, Rowan knows which students he wants to help him carve poles. It's then that some of them get to join Rowan in his workshop.
Because the school's different, you know. But once I leave the school and I start up at the shop for the city, then it's a job. And nice Mr. Rowan gets left at the door, and mean Mr. Rowan gets is who they see. And what they're learning, you know, good work ethic, which is, I hope, is what I'm doing.
During the ceremony, 2 plaques were unveiled, one listing the names of the carvers in the 1930s who recreated the poles from Tuxacan. The other commemorates Rowan and his students. The celebration in Kluak included more than just totems. Patrons browsed a native arts market during the days, and the nights featured potlatch feasts with food, dancing, and, well, you guessed it, cue the music. Hundreds of people gathered in the Kluak School Gymnasium each night to dine on crab, salmon, ham, salad, asparagus, potatoes, and, well, the list goes on. Tlingit dance groups from all around the region, including Ketchikan, entertain the crowd with songs of love and life. Devlin Enderstrom dances with the group from Yakutat. The 16-year-old sees the totem-raising ceremony as an important uniting force for Tlingits throughout the region.
I really feel like this pole-raising, it's also lifting up our spirit as Native people, and I think it's good and healing for us to be able to do something like this for Tlingit people all across Southeast.
20 or so poles have been raised so far since the early 90s, and both John Rowan and others in Kluak say there are more than 100 to go. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm John Carlson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Angela Denning-Barnes in Bethel, Jovic Nikki in Petersburg, and Sean Carlson in Kluak. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Where can you see more than 1,000 entertainers from Alaska Native dancers to pirates? The Alaska State Fair. This year, everyone attending the fair can enjoy music that matters, like Pure Prairie League, the Young Dubliners, John McEwen, founding member of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and Terry McDermott and the Bonfirers. We'll learn more at thealaskastatefair.org. Music, fair food, and fun. It's what the Alaska State Fair is all about. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.